This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The United States is a nation of immigrants, but it also has a long history of hostility to immigration. In modern times, certainly, no president has taken on the anti-immigration mantle as assertively as Donald Trump. During his first week in office, he signed three executive orders on immigration to begin building the wall, to cut federal funding for sanctuary cities, and the order that became known as the Muslim ban, which has just been expanded to prevent immigration from Nigeria and five other countries. And there's also child separation, the cancellation of DACA, preventing asylum seekers' entry. These are all initiatives from the White House policy chief named Stephen Miller.
Our opponents, the media, and the whole world will soon see, as we begin to take further actions, that the powers of the president to protect our country are very substantial and will not be questioned.
Our immigration reporter Jonathan Blitzer has profiled Miller in this week's issue of The New Yorker. John, you write about a moment in 2013, the last time that a comprehensive bipartisan immigration bill ever came before Congress. And you describe in detail about how a very young Capitol Hill aide, still in his 20s, named Stephen Miller, went about sabotaging the process. So what happened?
It's quite incredible. I mean, now we think, looking back, we think, you know, do Democrats believe in workable solutions on immigration? The issue is so polarized. How do we get both sides to come to some consensus state on the issue? The consensus existed in 2013, and the votes were there.
What was the consensus?
I mean, this was
just rough outline.
Sweeping comprehensive immigration reform that would have granted a pathway to citizenship to a large chunk of the 11 million undocumented people living in the U.S. in exchange for what were fairly typical establishment kind of hardline compromises, increased border security, increased enforcement personnel, the kind of tough on illegal immigration kind of measures in exchange for a legalization program.
So what role does an aide like Stephen Miller play in making it all crash and burn?
So at the time, there were already the votes in the Senate to pass the bill out of the Senate. But Sessions was in on all of the discussions, as were all of the Republicans at the time. For the most part, the hardline Republicans were thinking, okay, we can't stop this bill from becoming a law, but we can try to get our kind of key issues into it. Miller comes to the table as Sessions' communications staffer, not as his policy person. And the only thing that Miller is doing when he enters the room is he's listening into the conversations. He's cribbing what he can from the policy discussions. And he's learning how to take some of those policy details out of context, to pump them into talking points.
How did he do it?
You know, little things, little details that probably didn't even strike people in the room as being terribly consequential at the time. There was one measure, and this is a particularly dramatic one, where Marco Rubio, who was one of the members of what was called the Gang of Eight, who were driving this reform bill, Rubio, in a bid to show that he could be tough on crime along the border, proposed distributing cell phones to residents in the borderlands so that they could call DHS with reports of criminality, border crossings, things like that. Miller takes that detail and turns it into what he called amnesty phones for illegals. And in the right-wing media, that crazy detail starts to circulate.
Amnesty phones. Wow.
You actually can be eligible for a grant for a phone, it looks like. A two-year grant program to receive a cellular phone. And, and the articles this morning, as you can imagine, are fairly amusing. Move over Obama phone. This is the this is the amnesty.
That's a ridiculous example. There are, of course, much more sort of piercing examples that really scare Republicans. So, for example, there's always this issue of how are you going to deal with people who've committed crimes? Where do you draw the line in offering some sort of path to legalization for people with criminal records? So here's Kris Kobach when he was the Kansas Secretary of State in 2013, speaking very much in the same voice as Miller. In opposition to that bill.
This administration has been drawing a very strange line and saying, we don't regard you as a criminal, we don't regard you as a threat to public safety until you've been convicted in a court of law. Merely being arrested for drunk driving or arrested for assaulting a federal officer isn't enough. And I think that's a really problematic line.
So by the time the bill passes out of the Senate and makes it into the House, House Republicans are thinking, why on earth would we get into this?
So it's what we're saying is that A flack for Jeff Sessions played an important role in bringing a comprehensive immigration bill to Cropper.
That's right. He had just a total obsession with sinking that bill.
So the failure of that bill can be seen as a kind of turning point, certainly in immigration reform and the whole drama. After Mitt Romney lost the 2012 election to Barack Obama, the Republican National Committee commissioned a report that warned that if the party did not embrace immigration reform, it would keep on losing elections. And 4 years later, we have perhaps the most anti-immigration president in the history of the country. What happened?
Well, there's a key moment in between that from 2012 and the election of 2016, and that is in 2015, the Republicans take control of the Senate. They have at this point sort of ridden the tide of the Tea Party movement, the anti-Obama sentiment. Sessions now is in a position of more power than he ever was. And he and Miller in 2015 create a document called an Immigration Handbook for the New Republican Majority. And if you read that document now, it's actually uncanny how similar all of the policy proposals are to the very things that Trump campaigned on.
As a kind of playbook on immigration.
It's essentially a playbook.
How did Stephen Miller find his way onto the Trump campaign and the Trump circle?
Trump was not an obvious candidate for members of the restrictionist movement. All those guys loved Ted Cruz initially. No one took Trump seriously. And Trump wasn't someone who actually had a vision on immigration. His view of the issue was a kind of run-of-the-mill, illegal is bad, legal is fine. And that rankled with the real kind of hardline true believers, the Stephen Miller types. But a key figure in all this was, of course, Steve Bannon, who saw in Trump a real spokesperson, a kind of charismatic lightning rod type figure who could help, as he once told Jeff Sessions, personify these issues for you. And they can feed him his lines.
Because Trump is soft clay in this way? Because you can manipulate him and get him to say what you need?
To one degree, yes. But I also think that what Trump offered to them was a really kind of visceral identification with the cause. So when Trump famously descends the elevator at Trump Tower and talks mm-hmm. about Mexican rapists, there it is.
It's true. And these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to borders.
It's chilling to hear that even now after hearing it countless times.
Absolutely. But, you know, even then, as bald and over the top as that rhetoric was, immigration hardliners in the Republican Party didn't take Trump all that seriously. For one thing, he's launching this long-shot presidential bid. But what's more, at this point, there still isn't clear language about what Trump's immigration policy would actually look like. And that language comes later in the campaign, after Stephen Miller joins the campaign and becomes his principal speechwriter. And in August of 2016, just a few months before the November election, Donald Trump gives a major immigration address in Phoenix, Arizona. And that speech was written entirely by Stephen Miller.
This will be a little bit different. This won't be a rally speech per se. Instead, I'm going to deliver a detailed policy address on one of the greatest challenges facing our country today, illegal immigration.
What was different about that speech? Why was it so important?
There are two audiences for that speech. So this is, you know, only a few months before the election. You've got the Republican base. They want to hear a rip-roaring speech about immigration. They want the kind of caustic language that the president has used from day one and that's drawn them to him in the first place. And so the president starts the speech by talking about immigrant crime. He talks about the fact that because of the Obama administration, people have died in the U.S. who didn't have to. I mean, really the most extreme, outlandish things.
I have met with many of the great parents who lost their children to sanctuary cities and open borders. So many people.
But then there's also this other audience for that speech. And this audience is basically people who are inside the Republican Party, who are government officials, who are Hill staffers, who are already on the conservative edge of the Republican Party when it comes to immigration, and who want to be convinced that Trump isn't just a big talker, but there is actually an agenda that he will set in motion.
Zero tolerance for criminal aliens. Zero. Zero.
And that's where, in this speech, this 10-point list that he starts to rattle off has the kind of focus and specificity that immediately reaches this type of listener.
We will restore the highly successful Secure Communities program, good program. We will expand and revitalize the popular 287G partnerships, which will help to identify hundreds of thousands of deportable aliens in local jails that we don't even know about.
And I've spoken to a number of people who very much were the intended audience of this speech, who on hearing that 10-point list said, okay, you know what? In spite of my misgivings about Trump, I didn't like Trump. He seemed vulgar and obnoxious. He wasn't my type of politician, but no one else in the Republican Party, and obviously in the Democratic Party, has ever come so close to articulating such specific policy positions on the hard line of immigration policy that we're gonna cast our lot with this guy.
These 10 steps, if rigorously followed and enforced, will accomplish more in a matter of months than our politicians have accomplished on this issue in the last 50 years. That's what's going to happen, folks.
Is there any way of knowing how important Stephen Miller and Stephen Miller's influence was on the 2016 election victory for Donald Trump?
Think of it this way. There has never been an American president who built his campaign around the issue of immigration and later won on that campaign on immigration. And so it's not a surprise that you basically see the administration right now prosecuting its immigration agenda as though it's still campaigning. The idea of immigration policy and campaign rhetoric are one and the same with these guys, and that is a mark of how influential and successful Miller was in 2016.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to take our country back, folks. This is a movement. We're going to take our country back. Thank you.
I'm talking with The New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer. John has a profile in the magazine of Stephen Miller, the policy advisor who's widely regarded as the architect of Donald Trump's immigration platform. And in a moment, we'll continue with Miller's influence on the 2020 campaign. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. We're talking today about the enormously influential White House advisor, Stephen Miller, whose far right-wing views on immigration have become absolutely mainstream in the Trump administration. The New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer has written a thorough and important account of Stephen Miller, his rise, and his role in the White House. John, what's the relationship like between Trump and Miller?
What I've always heard is that they kind of have this good cop, bad cop sort of relationship that Trump really
Which
loves.
One's the good cop?
Yeah, exactly. It's a suspenseful question. I think for the most part, Trump likes to say, you know, I'd be open to this thing, but Stephen would never go for it. And that's kind of the dynamic. And it allows Trump to feel.
So the 70-odd-year-old president is trying to make sure that he's pleasing the young aide in his 30s?
You know, it's something that Miller, for all of his bravado, is actually very careful about. He knows that the kiss of death in this administration is to be identified as the brains behind the man. He can't let on that he is the one who effectively is manipulating Trump on these issues.
Back in November, the Southern Poverty Law Center released a collection of emails that Miller had exchanged with some editors at Breitbart. Those emails from 2015 to 2016 included links to white supremacist websites and novels. Do you think Miller's policies are influenced by that kind of raw ideology?
I think yes. He denies it, of course. I think what's specifically alarming about what came through those emails was, one, his source material, who he's reading. He's reading actual white supremacist websites that peddle the view that the white population in the U.S. is being overtaken, that, you know, the idea of diversity in the U.S. is tantamount to mongrel hordes.
Right. Cultural surrender. Did Miller suffer any consequences after the email dump? Seems not.
None. This is kind of one of the surreal aspects of covering this administration. In the broader public, of course, it was national news. I think in the White House, this was not really an issue at all.
For all the noise about many issues, including the wall, build the wall, build the wall, since Trump took office, what concrete changes has he made to our immigration system? How is it markedly different?
Well, for one thing, he has effectively ended the practice of asylum at the U.S. southern border, which the U.S. has obviously always seen in a bipartisan way as a key part of its identity. He's completely slashed the refugee program. In the last year of Obama's presidency, for example, the U.S. vowed to resettle 110,000 immigrants a year. Under Trump, the number is now 18,000. And so he's really dismantled kind of the whole of the asylum and refugee program, and through rules and regulations and a lot of obscure technical stuff, the White House has essentially redefined who can qualify for legal residency in the U.S.
I think Miller was behind the Trump administration's child separation policy, the most controversial thing of all, and he apparently advocated for ICE officers to yank children out of school, and in December, he instituted plans to use unaccompanied migrant children as bait to catch their undocumented parents. Why the focus on children?
Well, Miller's view is an extreme manifestation of what had always been a certain establishment position in some ways, which was border policy is going to help the U.S. control even who makes the trip to the U.S. And so for years, from the George W. Bush years through the Obama years, there was a thing that the Department of Homeland Security, in an Orwellian way, called the consequence delivery system. And the idea was, if you treated people harshly enough at the border, you sent a deterrent message throughout the region. Miller is so obsessed with the idea of punishing people at the border itself, it becomes an end in itself. And so his actual thinking on, for example, the treatment of immigrant children is, if you treat children badly enough, in theory, maybe you can scare parents away from ever traveling with their kids or sending for their kids once they arrive in the U.S.
As Adam Serwer once wrote in The Atlantic, the cruelty is the policy.
That's right.
The cruelty is the point.
That's right. And, you know, early on, even people like Lindsey Graham, who at the time was seen as a moderate Republican bellwether in Congress, recoiled from a lot of the positions that were propounded by Stephen Miller.
The reason we yank these things back is because Mr. Miller, I've known him for a long time. I know he's passionate. I know he's an early supporter of the president. But I'll just tell you, his view of immigration has never been in the mainstream of the Senate. And I think we're never going to get there as long as we embrace concepts that cannot possibly get 60 votes. One of the concepts that I just completely reject is that we have too much legal immigration.
That was Lindsey Graham speaking in early 2018. He has since become one of the president's most vocal defenders in Congress.
So much of what Miller proposes seems legislatively inconceivable or just totally outside the mainstream, long past any boundary of thought. What's the purpose of pushing such extreme immigration platforms? What's in it for Trump?
Well, from Miller's standpoint, there are two gains for Trump in taking that approach. The first is the conversation has shifted well to the right of where it's ever been. And second, Congress no longer has the power to legislate, given how polarized Washington is. And so for someone like Miller, why bother trying to water down a bill in order to lure moderates into voting for it? If there's never going to be a vote on any of these policies, if the politics are too intractable to begin with, then why don't you just enunciate your principles? This is Miller's thinking. Enunciate your principles clearly. Don't apologize for them and push in other ways. And I think that's really been the approach that we've seen. And it's frankly the scariest fact of his agenda now, that in the absence of Congress, you basically have the executive, which has wide latitude to exercise its discretion on immigration policy, doing whatever it wants. And increasingly now, the courts are starting to buckle. I mean, at this point, the president has appointed more than 180 new judges to the federal judiciary. A lot of, in the past, the nationwide injunctions that immediately blocked some of Trump's most aggressive immigration policies are being lifted by some of his own appointees at higher appellate levels in the judiciary. And so I think Miller's view is, look, we're playing the long game. This is a fight. Let's duke it out.
And, of course, that phenomenon will only increase radically if Donald Trump is reelected in 2020. Now, one person to rival Stephen Miller for power and access in the White House is Jared Kushner, who's been circulating a 600-page merit-based immigration bill. And I wonder how aligned Kushner and Miller are on immigration.
So Jared Kushner didn't wade into the space of immigration policy by choice. The president asked him to spearhead this effort to come up with a comprehensive immigration reform plan. And so the plan itself is the plan of someone who is generally moderate on immigration, but who is taking the temperature of the Republican caucus in Congress and obviously the White House. So from Miller's view, there is, on the one hand, a lot to like in Kushner's 600-page immigration bill, namely the fact that legal immigration is on the table, which is something that was inconceivable just a few years ago. And yet, on the other hand, there are some causes for concern for Miller that are in the bill, namely that the overall number of legal immigrants who would be allowed into the country doesn't change. And so for someone like Miller, who wants the net number of people entering the country to go down every year, this bill might be too moderate for his taste.
Are they buddies?
They get along really well. And they, where policy is concerned, make these situational alliances. They never say anything bad about the other person, which is something that in Trump's Washington is more or less unheard of. And they are kind of muddling through together.
So this summer, this is This is extremely important. This summer, the Supreme Court is expected to rule on whether the administration can cancel DACA. What's Miller's plan if this happens?
This is probably the most alarming prospect. It really looks like, and one's obviously hesitant to prognosticate and sort of try to predict how the justices will rule, but it really does look like, based on the oral argument, that the justices are pretty skeptical of the argument that the administration doesn't have the ability or the legal authority to cancel DACA. So it seems likely that that program might be under threat.
Is there an implication for the election?
There is. And I think what Miller will do is Miller will seize on that ruling to push all of the most extreme things that he has ever wanted. And so one person said to me, look, if you thought Miller was bad in early 2018, you're going to see that times 10.
But that's a winner for them? I understand why it's a winner for the base. Is it a winner for all those contested counties in the states that we know by heart as the crucial states in a November election?
It's interesting. I think that if you're a congressional Republican, this is just a huge headache for you. You don't want to have to go on the record one way or the other. You don't want to buck the president's position because the president's so popular with the Republican base. But Dreamers, as we all know at this point, are hugely popular in a bipartisan way across the country. And so why go after them at a moment when your own political future is at issue? I basically think the White House doesn't particularly care about congressional Republicans. I think this is what's in the best interest of the White House, at least as White House senior advisors see it. And so they're going to charge ahead, and Miller is going to essentially use the population of Dreamers affected by the Supreme Court ruling as hostages in a series of negotiations that he is going to force down the throats of Democrats on the Hill. And he is basically going to say through it all, and the president is going to say through it all, that the Democrats have an opportunity to help save these DACA kids, and they're not going to take it.
Jonathan Blitzer, thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Jonathan Blitzer's profile of Stephen Miller is available now on NewYorker.com. If you do a quick recap of the international news this past month, it might give you a panic attack. There's the ongoing crisis of the coronavirus, missile strikes in the Middle East, all kinds of headlines. And if they cause you anxiety, and they probably should, think for a minute about the people who have to respond to all these developments in real time, hour by hour. The complexity of world events can't be modeled by an algorithm, at least not yet. So diplomats, policy analysts, and senior military officials sometimes turn to very unusual tools to develop strategies. They play games. In 2018, Simon Parkin, who writes about gaming for The New Yorker, traveled to the Defense Academy of the United Kingdom to see one of those games firsthand.
There's a story from the Second World War that you probably haven't heard before. It's about U-boats. They were the Nazi submarine fleet, and they were causing a great deal of trouble for the British.
This is not a dressed-up propaganda story. It's telling you that this U-boat, one of the wolves that hunt in packs in the Atlantic, is as dangerous to your home as a 1,000-pound bomb from the air. There is no.
The Germans were using the U-boats to sink convoys of supplies en route to England at an alarming rate, sometimes hundreds each month. Winston Churchill came to believe that the outcome of the entire war rested on dealing with the U-boats. So he called up a retired naval captain named Gilbert Roberts. Roberts was a tactician, an outside-of-the-box thinker. And at a secret naval base in Liverpool, he came up with an unusual plan to help the Navy sink those U-boats.
Battleship!
He designed a game.
Battleship! It's loaded with action and suspense.
Imagine a game of Battleship, but the board is the size of an entire room. One person plays the U-boat commander, and the other plays the convoy commander. They give their orders from the side of the room, and aides draw out the battle in chalk on the floor. Here's Major Tom Moat. He's an expert on war games.
The movements of the escorts and the convoy were done in white chalk, and the movements of the German submarines were done in brown chalk that was exactly the same colour as the wood, so that the escort commanders who were giving orders for their ships couldn't see where the submarines were.
A lot of the naval staff was out at sea commanding escorts, so the players in Robert's game were mainly new recruits to the Women's Royal Naval Service. These Wrens, as they were known, were mostly 18, 19 years old. Every day they played out different naval battle scenarios in Robert's game. After a few months, an admiral, one of the most successful submarine commanders of the First World War, in fact, went to Liverpool to see what progress, if any, Robert's group was making.
He said, "I'll have a go. I'll be the submarine commander and I'll play against the convoy." And he was sunk 6 times out of 6. So he said, who was commanding the escort? And it was one of the 19-year-old Wrens.
Her name was Janet O'Kell, and she was actually 18. By playing this war game, she and the other women had come up with a strategy to sink German U-boats. And it worked.
Now, there's a moment there where, you know, the senior officer could get very crusty and very angry. But he didn't. He was like, that's incredibly effective. That was then made in to naval instructions and radioed out to the convoys. And 2 hours later, they sank their first U-boat.
Before one could say, "Hail Hitler," the escorting warships closed in around their precious charges and proceeded to teach the Nazis a lesson.
It's a story that probably deserves a Spielberg movie, but it's not unique. For hundreds of years, war games have been powerful tools for military commanders and diplomats. Even today, they are played at the highest levels all around the world.
I've played Matrix games in the USA. I have played Matrix games in China. Haven't done it with the Russians. Don't think I'm going to get permission.
But Tom's games aren't about drawing lines on the floor. In the era of ISIS and fake news, you need a new kind of war game.
Matrix games are very simple games based on oral arguments.
And Major Tom is an expert on Matrix games. If what the Wrens were up to in Liverpool looked like Battleship, Tom's games looked like a cross between Risk, Dungeons & Dragons, and a rap battle. I visited Tom at the Defence Academy of the UK, where he teaches young officers how to wage international war on a tabletop.
Could you just tell me a little bit about, so we've got on the table a board about the size of a picnic blanket that sort of got Ukraine at the top and goes all the way down to Egypt. Is this something you use in various...
In Tom's games, each player represents a country. You all sit around a map, and when it's your go, you say one thing that you'd like your country to do. A facilitator, which is kind of like what the military calls a dungeon master, asks the other players if they think that'll work.
Because, of course, the academic theory behind it is crowdsourcing the result.
There's a debate about whether you'll succeed, and if you can't all agree, well, that's where the dice come in.
I tend to use casino dice, just in case, so they're properly balanced.
Tom takes dice very seriously.
Now, of course, some people go, "Oh, you're rolling dice. It's just a game of chance." Well, if you think that, then you don't understand risk. And if you don't understand risk, then perhaps you really ought to be in another job.
Major Tom's games have a simple framework, but they do allow players to bring an almost infinite amount of complexity to the table. You can do anything you can imagine, or at least anything you can make an argument for. That flexibility makes these war games very useful for untangling the complicated reasons why countries act the way they do. I talked to David Schlepak. He's an expert in wargaming at the RAND Corporation in Washington.
I've been at this for a very long time. I go back to the Cold War, and so we use them to look at global nuclear war and how you get into it and how you manage not to get into it. The major success for us is, do we move the needle on policy? Do folks take what they learn from the games and use it to change what they do when they go back to their day jobs? When we were first starting to imagine a world where North Korea had nuclear weapons. And so we set up a series of games where we asked the question, well, what would it mean for North Korea to have a small number of nuclear weapons? And we brought in a very senior player, a very smart man, a very good friend of mine, actually, who had done time in the Department of Defense as a senior policymaker. And he walked into the room at the start of the game and said, well, look, I don't understand why this is even a problem. They have 2, 3, 5 nuclear weapons. We have 1,500 nuclear weapons. I can do this math. And then we played the game, and he walked out of the room going, oh, holy Christmas, this is a gigantic problem. This changes everything.
So to see firsthand how wargaming can change your perspective, I sat in on a game Major Tom was running at the Defense Academy. It was kind of a big day in international relations. You may remember it.
The British Prime Minister Theresa May has explicitly blamed Russia for the poisoning of the former double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter, and has expelled 23 Russian diplomats in response.
Come on in. No, we haven't actually started yet. So, who would you like to be with?
I'd like to be with Russia.
I thought you might. Grab a seat.
Straight off the picket line.
Like many people, I spent a fair bit of time worrying what Russia is up to. And this seemed like a pretty good way to get some insight. Now, for security reasons, all the players have to remain anonymous. But I can say that the guy playing Russia looked to me like a friendly university professor. He didn't much resemble Vladimir Putin, but he certainly had a talent for Putin's style of diplomacy.
Okay, Russia, what do you want to happen this turn?
I'm going to make a public televised announcement.
Yes.
Where we're basically going to indicate that the UK is a third-rate power that is throwing a tantrum in order to sort of distract attention from its own political problems at home.
That idea was debated by the group.
Very few people believe Russia anymore, and they know, and they believe full well that it's just obfuscation.
Does anyone think that that's going to make the UK government look worse or better?
I think it's very arguable.
And the dice came out.
Oh! So that was a 4. So the way it would be interpreted in the game is that Putin's attempts to discredit Theresa May actually increase her standing in the rest of the eyes of the world. So sadly, that one didn't work very well. Ukraine, what are you up to?
A setback. But it didn't discourage our Putin much. The next turn, he made a similarly gutsy move, offering to send humanitarian aid convoys to eastern Ukraine. Now, you may remember, that's the part of Ukraine that's sporadically under attack by Russia.
When I say humanitarian aid convoys, the urge to put air quotes round it is overpowering. Okay, now, Ukraine, will you accept these aid convoys?
Absolutely not. Yeah. Last time they sent aid convoys in, they were full of little green men that suddenly all had a Kalashnikov up their jumper.
Turn after turn, the other countries in the game tried to hem Russia in. The tactics they used were worryingly creative.
Also demand that the Russian ambassador attend the Secretary of State when we get a new one.
I'm taking Russia to the International Maritime Court of Arbitration.
We will conduct joint operational trials with the Queen.
Chechen sympathisers and separatists firebomb and attack Sochi naval base.
It could be easy to forget how complicated international relations are until someone gives you a seat in the Situation Room.
11! Congratulations on a spectacular bit of diplomacy. I don't know who you got to run it, whether it was Bill Gates.
When the game is over, Tom asks everyone what their nation's goals were.
Okay, Russia, what were your objectives?
Well, the first one, you could take it one of three ways, is to ruin Britain's international reputation. That, on the face of it, went completely wrong.
Yeah.
The second one was to basically maintain the position of our good ally Assad in Syria.
So, basically, the Russians have managed to manipulate events to achieve their goals. Even with 5 extremely creative antagonists and some bad luck with the dice, Russia still kind of won. They controlled the game. This, Major Tom tells me, is not unusual. Outside the realm of professional sports, with their stratospheric salaries and primetime TV coverage, games are usually viewed as frivolous, something that should be set down after childhood, probably only picked up again in retirement. But those who work at the highest levels of defence and national security view games pretty differently. Here they are seen as perhaps the most efficient, tactile way in which theories can be tested and refined, and through which vital, potentially life-saving experience is gained. In war games, the actions of nations, armies, and diplomats can be understood, maybe even predicted. And as warfare grows ever more complex, ever more frightening, the war games adapt, and the knowledge, the understanding they provide, could mean the difference between victory and defeat, even between war and peace.
Simon Parkin, his new book, A Game of Birds and Wolves, tells the story of the war games that helped to defeat the German U-boat menace. And it's out now. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Michael Shulman is a staff writer covering pop culture of all kinds, and he's interviewed an amazing roster of talent. In the past couple of years, it includes Peter Dinklage, Parker Posey, Frank Oz, and recently, none other than the great Pam Grier.
Pam Grier has a very unique place in popular culture because she emerged in the 1970s as the heroine of a genre usually called blaxploitation. And these were black action movies that were like nothing else that had come before.
This is skinny. Before you start talking tough, I better warn you, I got a black belt in karate. So once you get out of here quietly, they still got some teeth left in that ugly face.
They're outrageous, they're raunchy, they have sex and violence and drugs. While there had been movies before she came around, like Shaft and Superfly, she was the first female heroine of this genre. She's so much fun to watch and was sexy and funny and empowered and really like no one else who had been in movies.
This is California. It's supposed to be warm.
We're on the set of Bless This Mess, which is a sitcom about a city couple that moves to a small Nebraska town to be farmers. And Pam plays a woman who owns the general store and is also the town sheriff.
Y'all had an intruder?
What? Oh, hey! Yes, I called 911, but that was last night. You're just coming now?
Believe it or not, there isn't a code for a dead chicken. You can't call the sheriff when a chicken dies, just like you can't call a gynecologist when the internet goes dead.
Now, I want to point out that even though you're not actually filming any scenes today, you are still dressed as if you could be sheriff of a small town.
I just like this all the time. Yes. I'm sorry. Did I offend you?
It's amazing.
The smell of leather. It's deer hide.
Why did you come here to Hollywood and what were your first impressions of it?
Another planet. It's Nirvana. It's like a place you, from where I've been, you know, military bases and all my childhood, and the only place I had a beautiful outdoors experience was at the farm in Wyoming, and it was just dirt and the gray barn, you know, and then to come out to California and drive down Sunset Boulevard, I said, if I can just stay here, this is what I want to do. And I met some film students who were loading up a van of cables and cameras, and I had on a plaid shirt, kind of probably the same Levi's and the same Timberland boots that I have on now. And that's all I had.
About 10 years ago, she wrote an autobiography called Foxy, which is now being developed as a biopic. And in it, she revealed that she had been the victim of sexual assault multiple times, starting when she was 6 and then again when she was 18. And she talks about how that experience made her withdraw into herself. She was extremely shy. She developed a post-traumatic stutter, and she saw her own attractiveness as a real danger.
I didn't find myself sexy or pretty. I didn't even shave my legs.
You know, it's tricky because I think her image in those movies like Foxy Brown were so empowering for women and so alluring, I'm sure, for men who just thought she was hot. And she was coming up at the time of, you know, Black Power and Angela Davis. And she was kind of the pop culture version of that.
By a patriarchal society that allowed it, just it was okay to slap your mom or push women around or berate them or the food wasn't right. You would see that in many families. And that was the nature of the beast in back in the 50s and 60s. Hmm.
So your characters like Foxy Brown and Coffee were obviously so empowering and
witty.
And witty and fun. Part of what I love about those movies is that you could tell that they were doing things in all kinds of exploitation movies that they couldn't have done in movies just a few years before. There were some black critics who...
Very conservative
black
critics.
Writers who thought that it was perpetuating stereotypes of drug dealers and pimps and everything.
I kept telling them, where do you think we get them from? Those aren't stereotypes. We get them from reality. When a woman takes out her earrings and her shoes, she's going to whoop your behind. Okay? So that's in my movies. Okay? And certain cultures understand that. And other cultures would think it's black exploitation. We don't fight. We're conservative. Black people, we don't do that. The hell you don't.
One of her biggest fans from the 70s was Quentin Tarantino, who in 1997 cast her as Jackie Brown. Jackie Brown is a caper based on an Elmore Leonard novel called Rum Punch, but Quentin Tarantino wanted her to be in the movie so bad that he actually changed the main character from a white blonde woman to a black woman. Well, I've seen Quentin Tarantino point out that one thing he loved about your movies is that you didn't have an equivalent in white cinema. There was no white girl action hero. It was you, and I thought that was an amazing observation that you were just a true original.
It was interesting because my mom had a lot of white women friends, and they weren't allowed to speak back to their husbands like a black woman would. It was different in culture. Hey, we both go through so much discrimination and oppression. I'm not going to let you talk to me that way.
Right.
And there's not that oppression in a white family.
Can I ask you something about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? Because I was amazed at, first of all, the fact that you were dating him really before either of you were really famous, but also that he was converting to Islam at the time and wanted you to be his, you know, submissive Muslim wife.
First wife. I want to be first and the last.
So, but the two lives that you were choosing between, essentially, were so different. And you say that you really struggled with that decision. How did you decide what path to take?
I decided on me because I'd seen being married and validated by men in marriage. Some people fall in love with the idea of being in a marriage. Yeah, but if he decides to take it away from you, how do you hang on to it?
And this decision came down to this one incredible moment when he called you up and said, I'm marrying someone tomorrow unless you
come today.
Over. Today?
When he called me on my birthday and he says, so? I want to be able to give you your Muslim name. And I'm going, okay. You've had 3 months to decide, and I've given you the books. I'm here at the temple, and if you don't commit to marrying me and becoming a Muslim woman, I will marry someone this afternoon who's been prepared for me. Without all of that, he was the perfect. He loved jazz. He loved sports. He was an academic. He was just perfect for me. He could have been that first love.
Yeah.
But at
that's
that,
a pretty big
that
catch,
day,
though.
That day, he kind of took the eraser and went, and I said, okay, but I couldn't make him happy. He was so happy when he talked about his conversion and the religion. And I said, God, he just beams. I walk in the room, I don't make him beam like that. I don't make him, you know, be that happy.
In the mid-70s, she was in a relationship with the comedian Richard Pryor, who was at the height of his fame, but also very deeply in the middle of his drug problems as well. And Greer tried to be a positive force in his life, but ultimately, as she writes in her book, the relationship deteriorated. And the end of this relationship is particularly surreal, and I wanted to hear about this story, which was that Pryor was gifted a miniature horse, and he thought he should keep it around because Pam loved horses.
I come home, I get the call, and the horse is bleeding and has been attacked, and I'm going, and Richard's going to fall off the wagon. He's going to be so depressed, and he's been really good. He has no drugs, no drinking. I got to see a good side of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was nice to see that. I just knew there's going to be a bad time if this horse dies. And I saw him really, really love animals. He was sobbing from the core of his body like you'd never seen. And I said, we got to go. He says, well, I don't have a horse trailer. The vet can't come. We got to put Ginger in the back seat. But it's a Jaguar. Shut up. Let's go. Stop crying. Push, I pull. She got in and she was on her knees, her head out the window, tail out the back. The car went down, hit the asphalt, the pipes. I thought it was going to break down, the axle break. And he's get in the car. He's in his bathrobe, barefoot, and he's crying. I'm like, oh my God, Richard's going to have a heart attack. The horse is going to die, and I'm going to get in an accident on the freeway. So
I'd also like to point out that anyone passing your car would have seen Pam Greer at the driver's seat, Richard Pryor crying in a bathrobe in the passenger seat, and then just horse hooves like flying out of the back seat. That is nuts.
Yes, it was. And the vet said, we're all going to be outside when you drive up because we want to see this. They gave her anesthesia and stitches and surgery and everything, and she survived. And Richard said, you know what? You're funnier than I am. He said, that's the purity of where I come from, country. We're going to take care of what we have to take care of.
Well, it's a real honor and a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for your interest and your consideration.
Pam Greer. She spoke with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman on the set of ABC's Bless This Mess in Santa Clarita, California. And we should note that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's relationship to Islam and gender relations have evolved since he was in his 20s. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening today. And please join us next time for the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.